Hi, and welcome to Prosody, WYEP's weekly show featuring the work of poets and writers. I'm Ellen Wadey, and my guest tonight is the writer Kathleen George. Kathleen George is the author of three works of fiction, The Man in the Buick, a collection of short stories, Taken, a thriller translated into six languages, and Fallen, a thriller. She is a professor in the University of Pittsburgh Theater Arts Department. For Pitt and the Three Rivers Shakespeare Festival, she has directed many plays, and she has also written about theater and writing in three books, Rhythm and Drama, Playwriting, The First Workshop, and the newly published Winter's Tales, Reflections on the Novelistic Stage. She is currently at work on one more fiction and another book about theater. Hi, Kathleen. Welcome to Prosody.
Hi. Thank you.
How about we start out with you reading tonight?
Okay. I'm going to read a little bit from Fallen, and I'm going to start at the very beginning. To say it was all grief all along was stretching it, maybe, but not by much, Richard Christie thought. Evil, mistakes of the heart, cold-bloodedness were only the disguises, the inky shapes and cloaks. Sketching itself at the back of his mind when the case drew to a close were snatches of Nowhere Man, the sweet young voices of the Beatles conjuring his own boyhood. The song would have been playing on the radio as he raced into the house and out, hopped into his mother's car and dashed out moments later, eager for the next game or distraction. He tried to remember who he was then, what he felt, what sadnesses tugged at him. He supposed, in retrospect, he was lucky to be so ordinary. Inside the house on Beechwood Boulevard, Elizabeth is waiting for the detective. Eight times, eight visits, 1 week. She watches and waits. He's told her he won't be bothering her so regularly anymore. The person who killed her husband has not been found. That's the bare rock truth. 7 days, eight meetings ago, Commander Christie said the usual tough things about finding the killer. His sentences might have been spoken by any detective in any film, but his eyes were soft, full of feeling, and she never doubted his sincerity. He knew her husband a little. That was part of it, and anybody who knew Daniel loved him. And here she is, a week later, the funeral over by several days, the children back at college. A difficult decision, but if her work has taught her anything, it's that people need to take up their lives again. Here she is, alone. Yesterday brought a glimpse of what real desolation is, and today she got the whole blank canvas as she wandered through the house, almost dizzy with the space and silence. People called, of course, but less frequently now that the funeral was over. They'd expended their store of philosophy in those first 3 days of mourning. There was nothing left to say but anything new. Have they found anything? She turned the machine off because it was hard to keep saying no, no, nothing. The house is empty, the larder bare. The funeral meats are gone, unthriftily given to anyone who would accept cold cuts, pastries, roasts, ham, salads. Even the children took some of the surfeit. Elizabeth wanted the food and flowers out of the house. She wanted to throw away, same as when she was spring cleaning or tackling the basement. Anything, everything. Now there's nothing. She wonders, should she fill a pitcher with water, put out two glasses? The detective never takes anything. She walks back and forth inside her own house as if it belongs to a stranger. Outside the house and across the street at the entrance to Frick Park, a man in navy jogging clothes stretches and appears to look nowhere in particular except possibly at his well-clad ankles. Yet, between this reach and that, done awkwardly, he's not an athlete. He manages to watch Elizabeth's house. He wonders if she is alone in there. Runners run by. Children chase one another with shrill, ecstatic threats while their mothers attempt to herd them to the playground section, yelling, "Don't run! Watch where you're going!" The man is only a shadow in their peripheral vision, not noticeable or memorable. There's a reason for everything. Something good will come of it. A composite, invisible someone murmurs to Elizabeth. She identifies the composite voice as minister and neighbor and wife of colleague. Reason, she answers. What about just desserts? Dan didn't deserve to be cut off so young. His short good life was better than many long lives, the little chorus offers, trying to help. Elizabeth opens the refrigerator, a quart of milk, a chunk of cheese. At least the detective doesn't sermonize, and his silences are simple meanings. This is tragic. This is sad. There's a tap at the door. Elizabeth hurries to it and lets in her guest, her almost friend, the homicide commander with the sympathetic eyes. He asks, "How are you holding up?" "People have been very good to me," she says. The detective, Commander Christie, nods seriously. "I would hope so." She leans forward to close the door. Outside, the man in the park stretches, trying to imagine the conversation in the house. What do they say? He tells himself, "I should go," but he doesn't. How strange that life has handed him circumstances that put him here, now.
If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Prosody. I'm Ellen Wadey, and my guest tonight is the writer Kathleen George, reading from her works, including her most recent thriller, Fallen, from Dell Books. Kathleen, you know, I've noticed, I would say it's the way I kind of jotted it down on my notes, there's an insider quality to your writing. And what I mean by that is, and I noticed it in Taken, too, when I read that book, that one, I think there's a way that you look at things because of your theater background, and that detectives and kind of actors, directors, I think look at the same things a lot, which people might not immediately come to mind, but the idea of looking at the way people behave, their motivations, trying to figure out like what makes them tick, that I think is very similar. And I think that comes through in your writing. That's what I mean by this kind of insider. In a certain way, it almost feels to me like all that research that people have to do for the theater that never gets on stage gets to come out in your writing.
I think that's a great point. I am very interested in interior life, but interior life that comes out of somebody watching everything around. And you're right. I tend to have characters who interpret other people by the ways that they move or put down a coffee cup and very small things that are betraying emotional states. And it's funny because the Elizabeth character is a psychologist, a therapist, and she does the same thing with her clients. She has to read their movements and their silences and sounds. So I guess I'm kind of hooked on characters who do that.
Yeah, and it's what's really, you know, I think interesting and unique about your writing in that regard is that I think if there's not that real observation, if you're not trained in that observational quality, you do spend a lot of time describing detail, but not like why the detail's there. But in your work, I feel very pointedly that the details are all about trying to build up to something bigger, some kind of interpretation about either a person or why things happen the way that they happen, which I think is, in a thriller especially, compelling, because it's not, you know, sometimes it can be just about the plot and not about the characters involved in the plot, and that's not true in your work.
Oh, thanks. I'm glad to hear that.
One of the things, though, I'm curious about, too, is when you're writing in this genre, do you know from the beginning, like, who did it? As a writer, do you know who did it?
I might know who did it. I might not know a lot of other answers, and I might not even know that. What happens is that I seem to start with an image that's strong. For Taken, it was a woman seeing a baby that she knew was not with the right person and knowing something was wrong, and then she follows that. I didn't know what was going to happen. I didn't know if she would live through it. I followed the story, but I knew what the issues were. A woman who wanted a child herself and who saw a child in danger. I knew that that's how it all connected. In Fallen, I also understood from the beginning, in this case, who did what. It's not much of a secret. That man in the park is pretty threatening. But how he would behave and why he would have an obsession with Elizabeth were things that evolved as I wrote. And I would have to say that it came from almost acting the parts in my mind and feeling the feelings and then feeling what they would do next.
And so how does that translate, I guess, into the writing? Because that was one thing I was really, I think there's kind of two camps of writers, if we're going to, you know, split them apart and make them take sides. And
I one think is there are, yeah.
People who know immediately from the get-go, like, this is what's going to happen, and they write to that point of destination. And then there are other people, and for my own writing, you know, that I'm in that camp where I'm writing along, and all of a sudden something will happen. I'll be like, well, look at that. You know, where'd that come from?
It's exciting.
It is, and also sometimes confusing and frustrating and all of those kind of things. And so with something where, you know, ultimately the pieces all have to fall together in a particular kind of order, once you I'm not asking this question very well. I'm thinking in terms of the initial writing versus rewriting. Mm. Once you know the characters better, you know, and you know why they're doing what they're doing, do you find you're doing more work in revision in that regard to then kind of get things to fall together, or does a lot of it just surprisingly come out the first draft?
I guess I'm not so far along that I can say for sure, but I think each book is different. With Taken, I had only sentence revisions, not event revisions. The events were the events, and they started and they ended, and that was it. Fallen wasn't like that. I had to explore a bit more to find what the story was, and things changed a little bit along the way. So it isn't really the same from one time to the other, I think.
Well, and that's good to know, too, that if you're writing and continuing writing, that there's new things to discover each time you write.
Yeah, I'm not in the camp, though, that does an outline and follows it. I feel that what happens, and even if I try to make something happen, I feel a kind of falseness in trying to force the characters to do something to end up at a certain point when that might not be the way it happens. So right. I don't do that. I think it takes a lot more time to write this that way,
right.
Open-ended, because you're exploring the whole time and not writing to a certain specification. But a lot of thriller writers who turn out one book a year, and actually my agent would like for me to do that, they have to write an outline. They cannot do it that fast without knowing exactly where it's going. Mine is a slightly slower process. I mean, I write diligently and I write daily. So I can get a lot done, but I need time to explore.
Sure. If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Prosody. I'm Ellen Wadey, and my guest tonight is the writer Kathleen George, reading from her works, including her latest thriller, Fallen. Kathleen, would you read some more for us?
Sure. Do you have any preference between hearing more about Frank, the evil fellow in this, who's hopefully quite sympathetic, at least some of my critics have said that, and a young woman who is a very important character in this who comes in later on, Bridget.
I have to say, I always like the evil, dark character.
Okay. Well, we're going to see what he does that evening after he's been examining Elizabeth's house, and he's gone next door, where he sees the house is being emptied out, and he asks if he can rent it. He surprises himself. He didn't know he was going to do that, somewhat like the writer who doesn't know what's going to happen next. And he's feeling his way towards this finished vengeance, I guess, on his mind. He's gone to teach a class in screenwriting at Pitt. I know Pitt well since I teach there. And so this is his drive back to Ohio afterwards. It was 8:30, class finished. He carried a satchel with the sweats and running shoes stuffed in, lecture notes, class papers. He'd changed to jeans and a sweater for class. He walked to the lot on Forbes where he'd parked. He hadn't been very good tonight, kept losing his place as he spoke. Would there be complaints? He started up the car. He was hungry, tired, a 3.5-hour drive ahead of him, up Forbes, down Murray, onto the parkway and west. He drove in a dream. He passed into West Virginia, then Ohio. What had he done? What was he doing? 30-some years of waiting to get what he wanted and needed, Frank told himself. 33 years of feeling no matter what he accomplished, he was a zero, a cipher in the shadow of another, who thought of him as a boy who never had a chance. Stories of late blooming had always gotten to him, as if all along he knew he was putting in time, waiting to live. He felt like the old guy Kaiser, who worked at Paramount the first year he was there. Something is in the way, Kaiser kept saying, irritably waving a hand in front of his face, trying to get rid of the constant nagging spider's web that kept everything out of focus. old Kaiser, it turned out, had had cataracts. Frank felt that way. Something in the way. People thought he had been living a real life all along. They did. He managed to have relationships of one sort or another, but he knew himself well enough to know he chose the cool, acquisitive types for brief liaisons, and he messed around with the desperate ones, women broken down by something when he became overcome by a need for connection. He could do it 8 times a day, so long as the woman was cracked and broken. She started getting ideas she could put herself together. He dumped her. He knew himself anyway. Even had a wife for a while, up until 6 months ago. Officially, it was actually over 6 years ago, and she was one of the acquisitive ones. Easy to lose. No kid, though. Invented the kid. Never been a lawyer. Invented that. He'd been in a lot of cities. Cleveland, Detroit, Philadelphia, Denver, New York. Real estate? No, he hadn't done that. Made that up. L.A. scriptwriter and script doctor. That was the true tag until Paramount TV let him go last year. He had an IQ of 165, way up there, but it didn't solve everything. He got nervous. He hated to get nervous. He hated the sudden flagging confidence. If he could fix the world, he would make sure nobody ever got let go. They'd keep you on until you calmed down and got right again, or you found yourself another job. Blather. He was lying to himself. He didn't really care what happened to anyone else. He'd been held down all his life from being all he could be. Never had a chance, eh? And no wonder. No wonder. Too much interference. It didn't matter how capable he was. He couldn't even own his own name. Had to keep moving from one place to another, changing everything and making do. 48 years old, and he had no past. He was a made-up man, every day new again. His chest cavity was empty, no heart, just the outside. The hair, the skin, the clothes. But damn if the mind didn't keep working. The will. Welcome to Ohio. Highway signs were so friendly. His phone rang. He kept driving and didn't answer. Drove in a dream. An hour collapsed and felt like a minute, just as 30 years had collapsed to a day.
If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Prosody. I'm Ellen Wadey, and my guest tonight is the writer Kathleen George. Kathleen, you know, in Fallen, there's this kind of interesting ongoing theme about knowing versus action that seems to keep coming up. And, you know, I'm sure part of it stems from the fact that the book is about a sudden death and then trying to a murder and trying to figure out who made that happen. But on one side, the wife is thinking that somehow if maybe she knew what had happened, it could help undo what had happened. But she knows that's not possible. And then with this character, the idea of impulse versus consciousness, you know, that even though he thinks things through, he can still react at a moment kind of thing. And I was just wondering if you could just talk about that as a character trait or a way to kind of how you worked it through in the book.
Yeah, you made me think of a section that I thought I was really happy when I found it because it explained Frank to me, and it is about this very, very subject that he values consciousness. He doesn't want to be one of those people who is in denial, and he looks around actually it's during the same drive that I was reading about. He stops the car, he walks into town, and he thinks of all the people in all the houses who don't know what it is that's moving them and who take all kinds of indignities in life and that they're repressing because that's the way they get through. And he says that he is not the kind of person who wants to get through that way. He wants to be on that very edge of consciousness all the time, knowing everything. He knows everything he's ever done that's bad and why he's done it. To quote for just a moment, He, in a way, he was pure, more pure than most men. He acted on the moment. Accident and will were one in him. That was some sort of alchemy, wasn't it? To be guilty and innocent at the same moment. Consciousness, yes, but also what? An instrument of the gods. Ha! Shakespeare knew. Thinking and passion, not opposites. You could know and know and know. And no, but it didn't stop the explosions. That is very much influenced by Shakespeare, my study of Shakespeare, and his villains who are right there knowing what they're doing. Edmund and...
Yeah, well, and that's what I think makes them so sinister. And I think in a certain way, some villains have been cast the other way or looked at in another way, like, well, they just can't help themselves. You know, they didn't know what they were doing kind of thing. And, you know, with these kind of villains, especially if they're very smart, you know, in the passage you read, this is a very smart man. The idea that they know what they're doing is wrong and do it anyway. Yeah. It's chilling.
It is. It scared me.
And so
writing it scared me, honestly.
I was just going to ask you that because, you know, as you were saying, you kind of lived the characters in writing this book. Mm-hmm. What was it like to be him? To have to be in his mind?
It was very scary. What happened was I started out with an idea that I was going to write somebody that I knew somewhat who was a pathological liar and very, very smart, and that I was going to push that character to an extreme where he would commit a murder. And but I thought of that person as somebody I was so against, of course, and, you know, I held at a distance. And then as I wrote him, I had to keep getting closer and closer and closer, and I found myself sympathizing as well, and realizing that he'd been terribly wounded in early life and never got over it. Just never got over it.
And so when you were writing him, was there anything in particular you had to do to get back out of him again? I mean, I know there's times when writers are writing something that's very difficult to write, and you have to take that moment and kind of get into character, and then you also have to, like, get back out of them again so
just
they
like
don't haunt you.
Has to do, yeah. No, I would walk around the house, take a deep breath. I think that it really helped to have other characters like Christy, who's the opposite way, who thinks of himself as very ordinary and glad of it, you know. And the women characters, Elizabeth and Bridget, who found ways to like this man and to begin to understand him. So that helped pull me back.
Yeah, that's it's always good to have a cast of characters, not just have to sit with one evil one for too long. If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Prosody. I'm Ellen Wadey, and my guest tonight is the writer Kathleen George. Kathleen, would you read a little more for us?
Sure. Shall I stick with Fallen?
It's up to you. If you want to read from Fallen, if you want to pick a piece from Taken, so maybe people can get a sense of the other book that you have out there.
Taken is the first thriller. And I, you know, one thing that is fun is you get to write about things that you just like sometimes. And one thing I like is going to the beach in Cape May, New Jersey. And my detective has a vacation in Cape May. It's an enforced one. He wants to be on the case, and he's going crazy because he's not on the case. But he's there in Cape May. So I got to put in a couple of favorite moments of what it feels like to be there. He's sneaking out really, really early in the morning while his children are and his wife are asleep. They are sleeping. He takes his cell phone from the table in the living room where the sofa bed is opened up to leave only a few feet on either side in which he can move. The children are flung away from each other, each to a side of the bed, arguing in their dreams. Their already tanned bodies are flushed with yesterday's intense beach sun. From a slicker hanging on a door hook, he retrieves his notebook. His pager is still in his pants pocket. He does not go back for it. He slips the phone into his sweats and lets himself out the kitchen door to a third-floor porch. Below him, there are other porches, like his, with banners of T-shirts, towels, swimsuits. How alike people are, he thinks, in their unlikeness. The floorboards are wet with dew, slippery. He holds the banister and goes down the steep steps slowly, like an old person. When he reaches the yard, he stops to look at the herbs the owners have planted and offered to their tenants, a sweet gesture. But Catherine is not likely to be cooking complex meals. Catherine said she does not want to think about a pot or a pan for 2 weeks. Fair enough. Out to breakfast, even, she said. And he said, okay. She has needed a break. She needs love. He tried to make love to her last night and couldn't do it. Hardly slept again. An unquiet mind. Oh, how he likes this time of day. The sun is just coming up. Everything is fresh and still. He turns out of the yard and toward the ocean. He's not alone. A bicyclist here and there, a car starting up, a runner and then another. He's got the right shoes on, and so he begins with a light jog toward the ocean. By the time he reaches the boardwalk, he's running, too. An old man, a panting runner, passes him, says, good morning. How did it happen to him, the gray office every day, the dregs of society, when there's this other world of bright color, friendly breakfasts? He has half a mind to call up old Will and say, send me a ticket to Australia. Still fighting the bad guys, Will laughed the last time they talked. How did you come to be a policeman, Marina had asked him. I wanted to be special, he said. They were sitting in her living room. Her hand was on his knee. He was looking at his watch. She was smiling about his admission that he wanted to be special. He was awash in guilt, no time for his family, and there he was sitting with her, watching her eyes close and open up so full of everything. A woman filled up with emotion, tons of it, kept it in check. Marina said her fault was that she, too, was always trying to be special in some way to everyone, even to strangers. She said it was part of being an actress, a flaw that she was working on. She shook her head at herself as if she were the mother, the child cell standing before her right at the coffee table, one knee knocking into the other, a child trying to be special even then. The waves are low rolling waves, but the way they catch the light, the sun is nothing short of spectacular. The light is brilliant. It hurts to look, and yet he looks because it's better than a Christmas tree, better than prayer. Christy runs to one end of the boardwalk where the Fisherman's Cove restaurant is, and considers going farther on the sand to the lighthouse, but that will take a long time, and the children will surely be awake and waiting for him. He turns and starts back, working up the beginning of a sweat because the sun is shining now. There are lots more people running now. About halfway back to the apartment, he stops dead and sits on a bench. The panting man goes by again and says, "None of that now." The old man's joke has cheered him like nothing else has for a long time. Maybe because he's a reminder of a father, somebody's father, the one he didn't have, still alive, still panting.
Kathleen George, reading from her two books, Taken and Fallen. Thanks for coming to Prosody, Kathleen.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
You've been listening to Prosody, WYEP's weekly show featuring the work of poets and writers. Writers appearing on Prosody also have their work showcased in Chapter and Verse, a biweekly feature in Pittsburgh City Paper, the Arts Entertainment News Weekly, published every Wednesday. Prosody is produced by Jan Beatty and Ellen Wadey. Our sound engineers are Joseph Wolk and Lauren Wolf. Please tune in every Tuesday night at 7 for Prosody on Independent Public Radio, 91.3 WYEP.
She had a smile that swerved, she had a smile that curved, she had a smile that swerved all over the world. It's all wrong. It's all wrong.